Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
Wayne and I have tried the Legends of the Five Rings card game. I bought A Matter of Honor, which is the Ivory Edition's introductory pack, or introductory set.
Yeah, just like you said with Netrunner, Lyle, if someone else is buying the cards, I'm happy to play.
Yeah, and they've already banned one of the cards in my pack.
I know.
It's been out, it was released in December, and there's already a card banned.
Well, not to harp on it, but as you said, it seems like, you know, I don't know how many cards they've put out for Legends of the Five Rings, probably a lot. You know, you have to watch those card interactions. But the interaction the cards seemed to get banned because of seemed pretty straightforward and easy to spot. This from someone who, you know, has never made a card game, so, you know, take that as you will. But
we've made lots of card games.
Okay, published. Published. Okay. That anyone else other than us has played? No. Anyway. Yeah, just kind of surprised it got banned, because it seems like something they would have caught.
So for those L5R card game players...
who are now no longer listening.
Right. The card Well-Defended Farm is now banned. Oh, except you can play it if you're someone like me who only has A Matter of Honor, and I can play it in tournaments if I play it, play these decks as is.
Then who wants to do that in a collectible card game?
Well, they actually banned two cards, and the other card isn't in the pack. So
you lucked out, then.
The other on the exotic farmland or something? Mm. Yeah.
Anyway. It's an interesting game. I think we're still learning the rules of it, as with any game that, you know, kind of have to pick up and learn by yourself. So I don't feel we've gotten that deep into the strategy. But you and I were talking about how the setup is they have, you know, pre-made, pre-ordered decks. And you're kind of supposed to play through the instructions in the book, which on the one hand is really good because it teaches you how to play the game and it shows you what to do. But on the other hand, you feel as if you are not playing because you are simply following the instructions and, you know, doing what they tell you to do in the book. So I don't know. I kind of have mixed feelings about that.
So we played one of those joyless games and we did follow up with another basic game. And we weren't able to finish it because we just ran out of time. And tomorrow we're going to play, finish off the basic rules. So that would mean having the honor rules as well as the duel rules. But the introductory pack comes with crab and lion clans. And neither one of those is like a dueling clan. That would be dragon or crane.
So we'll be playing with honor rules is what you're saying.
I think so. Crab's not very honorable. So you'll be playing with honor rules. You know that discussion that we had two episodes ago? It was part two of the Strix review. About how we're friends first and a gaming group second.
Right, right.
Wayne posted something on his Google Plus. Was it your Google Plus or the Idle Red Hands Google Plus?
I believe it was mine.
Ooh, secret revealed. Who's the only one who posts on Google Plus and Idle Red Hands?
Hey, who's the only one who manages the Twitter stuff? I think people have figured that out already.
Google Plus? What?
I still have a Twitter account, but Wayne ruined it.
Keep bringing that up again every episode, why don't you?
Just broke it on me. But I am able to access Google Plus, because I don't let Wayne touch my Google Plus, and I noticed that he posted about that. And some people raised some good points.
It seemed like the majority of people responded that they also play with friends. A couple people, you know, didn't see those groups as being mutually exclusive. But I guess the sense I got is that some people obviously play at game stores or, you know, other kind of public places. And I was specifically thinking of like D&D encounters or other organized play events where the people you play with, who you might play with on a regular basis, are not necessarily your friends.
The people who you hang out with, right?
Right, right.
But some of the points they made I liked was that once you start playing with them, they quickly become your friends. So it's the transition is pretty quick, or they invite friends to, or almost like a test that one guy said is like if they start to like somebody, they're going to invite them into the activity that they really enjoy. Just like you would invite somebody out if you like drinking. Right. You'd invite them out drinking, or you might invite them out to watch a hockey game or a football game.
Or if you're an alcoholic, well, then maybe you find them when you are drinking, and then they become your friend.
Yeah, and then you kind of trick them into doing a game.
Right.
Oh, where'd that D20 come from? Sorry, I just dropped that.
Yeah.
The alcoholic role player? What is... You know what I like to do when I drink? I like to play a game.
I'll maybe tell you when I've rolled enough.
Man, the guy had a lot of shame from the 80s, so they can only play when they're drunk. It's like drunk dialing people. You want to play? What did you roll?
Yeah, that's creepy.
That is pretty creepy.
Lyle's a scary drunk. Yeah. What did you roll?
No. I was thinking like you just call someone softly. What did you roll?
Breathe into the phone a little bit.
But trying to think how to bring it back to games.
Friends.
Drinking.
Drunk, I don't know.
Yeah, we're back in the same place.
Did I ever tell you about the time? It was towards New Year's Eve. I think it was in Calgary. Or Calgary, if you're from there. And I was on a bus or a train. I'll say a bus because I can't remember if Calgary has trains.
All right, everything's kind of hazy.
Yeah. Oh, did I mention I was drinking?
With that guy. And he didn't actually drunk dial me. He just whispered in my ear.
I mentioned it was 9 a.m.
Creepy.
So, and this guy was on the phone talking to... Well, it turned out to be a very young girl. I'm gonna put her at either early high school or junior high school. And he was in his 20s, I would guess. But kind of gamer 20s, so he had the beard and that, so it makes it difficult. He could have been in his 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And what he was saying, in a sense, was really reasonable. He was like, well, please check with your parents, and please tell them our ages, because, you know, they need to be comfortable with you coming over on New Year's Eve. To play a game with us, you know, we're not gonna be drinking or anything like that. But, you know, like we're all got it. You have to let them know we're all like university students or older, and you know, gonna be and show them the game, so you know, and everything. And I thought what he was saying is reasonable, but also, just the age of the girl that he was talking about,
right?
Talking to, sorry.
So what he was saying was completely reasonable. The fact he had to say it was kind of creepy.
Odd. I'll say odd because
okay,
I don't think.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, that's softer. Yeah,
it was odd, and then it was like. I mean, it's not a male-female thing, because it would be nice if she had other junior high school or high school kids to play with.
Right.
It was just kind of a socializing thing. Like, I don't know, kind of seemed a bit, I guess Dungeons & Dragons, you could play with anybody. I got the sense that that's the game they were playing.
Right.
They weren't playing Vampire or something.
Because then he wouldn't have said, show the book to your parents.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right. And,
Yeah, and you're going to wear that outfit, right?
Oh, jeez. No.
But I, it just struck me, just the age gap, and I don't think I've ever played with that age gap, at least when it comes to the preteen and 20s. I mean, once you're in your 20s or whatever, then, I mean, it's no big deal to play with a 50-year-old.
Right. Mm. Yeah, that's true. Once you kind of hit, you know, the adult marker, then playing with other adults, regardless of age, is not that odd.
Yeah. So, well, speaking of games, we're going to be talking about games.
In case you haven't listened to all the 140 episodes before this one.
This one's going to be a little bit more explicitly game. It's in a sense, very meta, a game within a game.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to say it was because of the Winter Olympics, but really it's because of the Hunger Games.
But you finally read and watched.
Yeah, I finally got around to reading that. I wasn't really sitting on that book for a long time. I just didn't have it. And then Wayne lent me the book, and I read it, and I enjoyed it. I thought Suzanne Collins,
yes,
she's a really good writer, and just a lot of interesting things came up in that book. So thought it'd be interesting to talk about it because it does have parallels with certain movies that we've seen. I think the ones that come up the most often are Battle Royale,
mm-hmm.
and The Running Man. But we also thought of something that other people have seen the comparisons to, The Walk. Another Richard Bachman or Stephen King book or novella. And of course, there are other where you have Dangerous Games or...
Or The Most Dangerous Game.
Yeah.
Right.
Was that a book first or just a movie? But
it was a short story, I thought.
Oh, okay. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And we're going to talk about certain decision points or decisions that you need to make when you're planning these type of games in order to shape the world and, of course, to shape the game.
Okay, so the first topic we look at is whether the game itself is a part of the story or if the game all-encompassing is the story. And an example of this would be well, actually all of the examples we mentioned before, where the Hunger Games, Running Man, I didn't see The Walk, but those are, that the story is about those things.
Well, I think The Hunger Games is a really good example where the first book is, the game is pretty much the story, but then the trilogy, and I haven't read the next two books, but how it ends, I would guess that the story now expands to, well, the game is just part of the story. It's now really about the world.
Right.
Well, you even kind of get that, and I haven't finished the third book, but you even kind of get that in the first book, in, like, there is stuff happening outside of, you know, the Hunger Games. And we get a little bit more of that in the movie, you know, just to kind of show what the characters are doing outside, especially with, you know, Haymitch the mentor and Gale. We kind of see a little bit of what they're doing. But, I don't know, you contrast that with something, I don't know, like the Most Dangerous Game, where there's no outside.
I'm actually glad you said that, Wayne, because I kind of disagree with you a little bit, just a little bit, in that I think if the Hunger Games were its own book, just the first one there, and it didn't include the second and third, I think that you could look at it to where the book is about the game itself, but all of the surrounding events that are going on are the build-up to and kind of just fleshing out the world around it. But you're right that, for example, the Most Dangerous Game is simply about the game itself, though I think... it's been ages since I've read it, but I might be remembering incorrectly, but I think there are flashbacks within the story as well. But anyway, I think that's, even if the game is about the game, that sounds redundant, there's no reason to just say that it's only within the game. You can also pull additional elements of the world into it. They do that in the Hunger Games movie, I think, because where they intersperse while they're actually playing the game with the things that happened before and after, like their interviews that were happening and TV spots and events and things like that.
Right. I was going to say, I think if you're doing this as a role-playing game, then this is going to be redundant. If the game you are playing is only about the contest, then flashback scenes are a way to, you know, do something new where it's not about the game anymore, and you can you might have trouble bringing multiple characters into them, you know, mm-hmm. because then it you know, especially if you have different setups, well, then it wouldn't make sense for these people to have interacted, you know, before the actual game. Mm-hmm. But if the game you are playing is going to extend beyond this contest that the characters are involved in, well then, yeah, you're going to have opportunities to do things outside of the arena.
Mm-hmm. And that's always good, give the characters some variety.
Yeah, but I think The Hunger Games, at least the first book, is a good example of what you can do with the game. You have, like, the build-up, then you have the actual game itself, and then you have the aftermath a little bit.
Mm.
But I think that whole book or that whole movie really is just the game.
Right.
It just happens to hint pretty strongly that there's going to be more.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas something like The Running Man, at least the movie, less so about the novella, but still that was pretty much the game. I guess that's more classic. It's all about the game because you get there and the resolution seems to be the end of the game.
Mm. I think that's what I was going for, and that's something to think about with this decision point is the resolution of the contest the end of your game?
Mm-hmm.
Or is the game you're playing going to continue past the end of the contest? You know?
And I think that sets up another decision that you would need to make. And this deals with the structure of the game that you would have. And that is, are the contestants expected to survive? And this is a good time to point out, we are going to have some minor spoilers in this episode. But you got to imagine that any book we're talking about, at some point the protagonists are in a game that's going to be pretty deadly. And sometimes they survive, and sometimes they don't, and sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it isn't. But.
Right.
And this is an example is, in a movie like The Running Man, they're not expected, or The Most Dangerous Game, they're not really expected to survive.
Right.
The prey, the hunted. I suppose you could play a game where you play the stalkers. And in a game like, a movie or a game like The Hunger Games, somebody is expected to survive. That's the point of it. So if somebody survives, it doesn't break the game.
Right.
That was what was expected. If somebody survives the running man, you're like, well, it's broken, so what happened? So you've kind of like, okay, we're breaking this apart.
With a lot of explosives.
Right. No, I hadn't thought of this, but making that decision point or deciding which type of game you're going to run sets up what type of characters you can bring into the game. Because, like, for example, the running man, no one is expected to survive the game. And so what kind of contestants do you have? Well, you have people that the government wants to get rid of, and that people are going to enjoy watching being killed, because nobody is expected to survive. Whereas, you know, like the Hunger Games or Battle Royale, someone is expected to survive, and so the characters who get tossed into this contest in this game can be sympathetic or just regular people.
No, I understand what you're saying. You're talking about, I mean, in both cases, you can have very sympathetic protagonists. It's just how the government will portray them. In something like The Running Man, the government will portray them, as you said, Wayne, as criminals. Mm. And of course, they can be complete lies. Right. And they have a motivation. They want to get rid of these people. Because you've got to imagine society at large, unless the entire society wants to see... And then you might switch over to, like, the way Spartacus portrays Rome. You know, it's a very bloodthirsty society. They just want to see anybody die. It doesn't matter if they're noble Spartacus.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or you contrast it with The Hunger Games. It's because somebody is expected to win and is going to be, like, a hero and a winner. Then they can portray them all as very, very sympathetic. And I actually think the book and the movie as well, they do a good job of showing the character Caesar.
Okay. Right.
Who's I guess he's like the host.
Yeah.
And he, I mean, that's part of his job is to present the characters in the best light. And of course, in the book, the main character Katniss thinks that it's like, oh, like he tries really hard to do it. And I think Stanley Tucci does an amazing job of showing that in his acting, that he's trying to help them. Wins the sponsors, like rich patrons.
Right.
He's trying to help them win over the crowd because that makes the game more exciting because people are going to care about these people and people are going to have favorites and root for them. Whereas in The Running Man, people, and I'm talking mostly about the movie because the book's a little bit different.
Right.
Or the story's a little bit different. Is people place bets on the stalkers. They're the celebrities, the people that hunt these contestants. And in most games, unless you play kind of antisocial gaming group, right, full of sociopaths, you're probably going to play the runners, as opposed to the stalkers.
No, I completely agree. And again, you saying that, I think the Hunger Games, you know, intentionally, we're obviously supposed to, you know, empathize with the runners, as you put it, you know, because, you know, the rest of society is pretty beaten down, and this is a horrible thing they have to go through. But if you were playing this as a role-playing game, I think using something like outside sponsors would be an excellent way to make players want to create those sympathetic characters, or at least likable characters, because... You know, we haven't really gotten into the setup or building characters for this type of game yet, but, you know, why would a player not just make kind of like a killing machine and dump all their points into, you know, athletics and firearms and whatever else is going to help them survive, as opposed to social things, because everybody in this contest is going to die, or you know, they're going to kill each other, so inside the arena, social skills might not be that useful, but if you then add the extra layer of sponsors or crowd favorites or somehow getting the people outside of the game to like you is going to be a benefit in the game, again, I think that broadens the type of characters, at least the skills that a character would have in the game.
Well, if we jump back to our Gladiator episode way back when, we talked about that then as well, that you know, just killing other people is not the most important part of being a gladiator. The most important part is putting on a good show. And we talked about how you might be able to incorporate, either mechanically or just through role-playing, how the effect of the crowd being excited affects the gladiator, or how he might gain favors from the stable master if he's more popular afterwards, after the matches. And you could easily incorporate that into this kind of a game as well. But also, I want to say that the idea that social skills might not be that necessary, I kind of disagree. If you look again at our primary example, the Hunger Games, you see how a lot of people join up and form alliances, albeit temporary ones, inside the Hunger Games. And that's I think, something important. If there's enough people to where you can group up into teams, you have to be able to convince the other people that, you know, you're not going to backstab them right away, even though everybody knows it's coming eventually. So I think in that case, maybe bluff is important. Or if you're part of a team and trying to be the leader, then some kind of leadership skill or some kind of ability to give a speech or something might also be very important.
No, I absolutely agree. And I didn't mean that, you know, social skills would be completely useless, because you would be forming teams or, you know, trying to trick people to do things. But it was like, ultimately, when you get down to the last few people, are you going to be able to trick someone to walk off that cliff? You know, maybe not.
Or eat a handful of poisoned berries or something like that.
Right. Right.
Wasn't it that that big Survivor episode, that TV show a while back, where the guy who won it was like a 50-year-old guy?
Richard?
Yes.
Yeah, Richard. Yeah.
Yeah, but again, part of the reason why he won is because he needed outside help, right? The winner of that contest has to be voted.
Mm-hmm.
And so if your game has something like that, where it's not the person has to be the last man or woman standing, but instead just has to get enough people who are eliminated to like them, then social skills become much more important, you know?
I think that guy's strategy in Survivor was he voted off people in alphabetical order.
No, maybe.
So, I mean, not really a social skill, it's more strategy.
Hmm.
But so if people knew how he was going to vote, so he's very open about that, so then people found him predictable and in a sense more trustworthy. I think that's how it worked.
Fair enough. That may have been strategy on his part for him to be able to say, it wasn't that I didn't like you, it's just your name was next in alphabetical order, and that's just how I voted, and I can back that up and show you that's what I've done. And mm-hmm. there may or may not have been, you know, manipulation going on there, but I see that as him being able to fall back on the use of a social skill and say, sorry, that's just how I voted, and, you know, you don't have to like me. You just have to like me more than the guy I'm up against.
Exactly. It's one of those things. I don't have to run fast, just faster than the person.
Exactly.
Next to me.
Exactly. You just have to hate me less than the other person at the finish line.
I mean, this leads into something that we weren't planning to do straight away, but it gets into how the game is shaped, and that's one thing is how are the contestants formed? Are they teams or are they individuals? Because you guys touched on that when you said that, like, for example, in the Hunger Games, they're individuals, but they can form alliances until that point of time where they have to be, you know, back to individuals.
Right.
But some games could be teams, like something like the Running Man. There's no reason why they can't team up. In fact, they have every incentive to team up, mm-hmm. if somebody can help defend against the stalkers.
Right.
You could have opposing teams. It's a different type of game, but it's like Rollerball, you know, they're just... Mm-hmm. It's the future deadly game, but it's actually more like a professional sport as opposed to a reality TV show.
Right.
But then you actually have teammates in that. So that's another thing to consider. Some gladiatorial games would have teams or pairs of gladiators fighting against other teams or pairs of gladiators.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I kind of thought of it just now, but what about the movie Cube? I mean, it's kind of a game setup.
Yeah, in a sense, it has kind of the rules that you have to follow and the trick to it.
Right, the goal is to get out.
Yeah, so it's not really fighting, but yeah, I'd say it kind of fits the definition of a game. But then by that's kind of so does Saw.
Right.
Mm. Okay.
Thanks, yeah. Wayne.
Sorry. All right.
Pandora's yeah. box open.
The rules of warfare. But you're right. I mean, in that case, if the game is... I think there was a supervillain called Arcade. No, I think he's still around, actually. And he'll build, like a dangerous funhouse. So, yeah, I mean, it's a game for him. But that Saw or Arcade, that's a nice case where you're not really competing against other players.
Right.
But you're competing against the environment.
Hmm. So that's like the wussy version where you don't have to kill anybody. Real.
Yeah, you have to avoid being killed.
And right. Saw is totally the wussy version.
I think players, and the same with Cube, I don't know. Maybe this is just, obviously this is my bias, but if a game goes on where the players don't have the opportunity to kill something or hurt something, then maybe they might be frustrated because always having to outthink something is a lot of fun. But when people start dying, they'll be like, I just want to kill something to stop the dying. And they might feel like, oh, come on.
Right. Well, I was thinking back to what you said about Rollerball, like putting all the players on the same team is a way to, you know, prevent people having to, one way to prevent people from having to sit out. Because let's face it, if the object of the game is to be the last person standing, that is going to mean eliminating other player characters, and what do you do with that player when their character dies? You know, being on a team, like Rollerball or, you know, like Blood Bowl, to use the fantasy football thing, you don't have to describe everybody on the team because there's going to be more than enough, you know, teammates for people to play as, and then when someone dies, well, you just switch to another person.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, it would be very hard to do a game like straight up Hunger Games. Mm. I mean, when you read Hunger Games and you see like Peeta and Katniss, and you're like, wow, they're natural protagonists. But it's and then you have Rue, but you're like, okay, like at a certain point, you're like, are we going to keep doing this where we'll get down to you three and you guys can fight it out,
right?
Or are we going to get to the point where I mean, this is when you play as individuals that, okay, you're going to get to a point where you're going to can't take it anymore and you will try to fight the game or fight the system as opposed to fight each other. Hmm. So a lot of times an individual game probably would come down to that because otherwise you might just end the game at, okay, there's you three. Do you guys want to just sit here and roll dice to see who kills who? Yeah, okay. All right.
Right.
And then the game's kind of over because...
Right. Well, I guess the other thing to do is, it may be a little bit cheap, but it keeps the game from devolving into player versus player, is then the environment just becomes, you know, so dangerous where someone is going to die.
Yeah. No, it'd be like, no, don't worry, guys, You all die.
Right, kind of
like... Oh, that's better. I thought I was the sole survivor. Nope.
But, no, I mean, that's kind of a bit of a cheesy way to do it, in my opinion, but... You know, kind of.
Well, really cheesy is what the Hunger Games did.
All right. I thought you said you weren't going to do spoilers.
Oh, like you expected that. It's aimed for what? Teenagers?
Not making it better that we read it.
Right. So unless it's The Chocolate War, which is the most depressing book for teenagers ever. And amazing. An amazing book. Most books do end kind of like The Hunger Games.
Right. Right. Well, speaking of that, one thing I was thinking of, because, you know, of course, after reading The Hunger Games, I've wanted to run a Hunger Games-style game, is because you have the mentors outside of the game, one thing to do is run both sides of it, where every player has both a contestant and is someone else's mentor outside, and
then...
That's
cool. I like that.
I couldn't figure out how to make it work or how you would kind of switch back and forth between the two because, again, you kind of run into the problem of are you going to run, you know, part of the game where someone is a mentor and, you know, another person is a contestant because the GM can't really be two places at one time. So you'd have to, of course, you know, work things out where everyone is now going to play the mentor in this scene and now everybody's going to go back to the contestants. So it doesn't exactly solve the problem of, well, my contestant died, and so I'll just sit here during these scenes.
That'd be a good way of kind of working in those social scenes that you're talking about. Then, depending on how well people do, maybe their players get some kind of sponsorship items or bonuses or advantages or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, what's the incentive to help? If the players are competing, but then they switch as mentors? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I thought it would be kind of boring to play your own contestant's mentor as well. I thought it would be a bit more interesting to play the mentor of someone else. But as you're just going to bring up, like, what's the incentive for a player to do that other than it's the rules?
Take the medicine. Oh, and it's poison.
Yeah.
All right, I guess I'll stop playing the mentor now.
I failed in my duty, sob.
See, this is why being friends helps, because we wouldn't do that.
Well... When you play the game of games, you win or you die.
Right.
It sounds interesting. I don't know. It sounds like...
One of those things is good on paper. How do you implement it? Right.
Yeah. I definitely see the appeal of trying to incorporate, again, using the Hunger Games, the mentor side and the sponsor side. And people not familiar, it might be self-explanatory, but the mentors are past winners who help train the current contestants and then act as a liaison between the contestants and sponsors, as we said, the patrons, people that pay money to provide them with things within the arena.
Right. It's kind of like the more public support you got that was, you know, drummed up by your mentor, then patrons would actually send you things in the game. And so, you know, the more well-liked you were, the more useful stuff you got sent.
I mean, that is tough, even if you were playing it as you're all part of the same team, because you're in such different arenas. The mentor is in the schmoozing, the party arenas, whereas the other person's in the arena where you fight.
Right.
They don't really interact, so that's also hard to play when you have players that are in different locations.
I don't know. It's especially if you had something like the Hunger Games where you have... a rather high technology world, that's not really an obstacle. You can have like a one-way communication that only the mentor and player are able to speak through or something like that.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you model it on the Hunger Games, then it really is a one-way connection where only the mentor can send things to the contestant. And
as far as interacting goes, you could set up certain times during the day where they're able to speak or something, or even maybe the game is like a gladiatorial thing where it only takes place during the day.
Oh, that's possible, yeah. And you all start from the same place again next morning. And you're like, oh, great, the cornucopia again. Shortest game ever.
All right. Some Hunger Game fans are laughing right now.
Of which I am one.
I thought the Hunger Games did a good job of using the rules. I think it's a little bit different than this decision point about teams and individuals. But I just think it's a good example where you use the rules to help manipulate the players.
Yep.
So you can force them to go to or strongly encourage them to go to the place. They also manipulated the environment as well. So a little bit railroady in a sense, but I mean it is an idea of how you can change things. The Running Man as well. I mean, they changed the rules by putting out two stalkers instead of one.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I tend to think if you are running this kind of game, then it pretty much goes without saying that whatever organization is in charge of running the game is going to try and screw the contestants over. So I think this is a type of game where railroading and changing up the rules would meet with less, you know, kind of complaints than a normal game.
Yeah, well, I'm going to disagree.
I actually don't really see it as railroading because it's in-game. It's part of the way the world works. It doesn't seem like it is railroading, but I don't see it as being kind of a bad type of railroading.
I'm going to disagree with the contention that the game masters are necessarily there to screw the contestants. Because I mean, sure, in the Hunger Games or the Running Man, they're kind of constrained by it has to be entertaining and it has to be believable, I believe, to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to say that you couldn't run a game where once you're in that game, you can't violate the rules, and it's really honorable that everything stays fair, and that they could even punish contestants who are doing something that's unfair. So if your players tried to cheat, I mean, they would have to do it stealthily because they would be punished, not because that the people that are overseeing the game want to screw them, but because, mm-hmm. oh, you're violating the fairness, you wouldn't be able to win honorably. And that right. is something that, I mean, I'm thinking of Japan, even though I know Japanese people cheat. But, you know, people might think, you know, oh, the
blanket
samurai
statement.
Code. we'll cheat just as much as everybody else.
There's the one you want to use.
But they have things like where, like when you play, when you have a kendo match and one person wins, even the most, even the slightest show of, not enthusiasm, but what could be considered being a poor winner, would mean that they would immediately take the win away from you. And you, okay. like, you lose the match. Like, they have such a, like, a code where we have, like, you know, I mean, you have things like, I mean, when you look at what Richard Sherman said after that football game, the cornerback for the Seattle Seahawks, and people said, well, you know, that's poor sportsmanship, and I don't necessarily agree. But nobody took the win away from the Seahawks
right.
over the 49ers, whereas, like in kendo, they would go, all right, you shouldn't have said that. You lost.
Right.
Right. So you could actually create a system. It's like where it is really, really honorable, and even though it is deadly, they won't violate things.
So in other words, you're fighting Klingon Hunger Games, where everything is about honor.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, that's a great example that people might be able to get behind. It's like, no, it's a great honor that you got chosen for this game, but I don't do it. Oh, that's too bad. But it's a great honor, and like nobody's going to cheat, you know? Somebody, or maybe somebody commits seppuku because they accidentally, or they killed somebody dishonorably, and you can work that into the game. I don't know. It's a different dimension. I'm not sure if it's definitely the default for what we're talking about, but it's certainly something that you could include.
No, I do like that, and I didn't mean to imply that if you're running this type of a game that the GM is going to play, you know, as an antagonist GM, because, you know, nobody really likes that type of game, or I certainly don't, but the GM still has to be fair, but I just thought that given, well, apart from what you said, Lyle, the game could be set up as this kind of very honorable, you know, competition where whoever wins is, you know, gets some, I don't know, position of prestige or power, and kind of goes back to the beginning about, you know, when the contest ends, is your game over, and kind of like, how is this game integrated into society? You know, is it like a secret, you know, kind of like the most dangerous game, or is it something everybody knows about, like the Running Man? But I thought more where the entity controlling the game could manipulate things to push the characters in different directions. And I know it's a fine distinction, but that doesn't necessarily mean the GM is kind of out to get you.
Well, yeah, just make up the rules for the world, whatever those may be, and then follow those rules, even if those rules are initially unfair. As long as the players understand that and are okay with it going in, then, yeah. Why not?
Right. Was it Battle Royale that had the injected...
Schoolgirls? Oh, yeah. Sorry.
All right, Mr. Creepy. Sheesh.
Just kidding.
Yeah. Anyway, I was going to say, was it Battle Royale that had the... Like, the kids were actually implanted with bombs?
They had the collars.
Right.
That also were tracking devices, and that's a bit of a spoiler.
Well, okay. No, I don't know how to do it, but I kind of thought of that of when you were talking about the honorable society, where it's not so much as we're going to be honorable, it's just like, we have now prevented you from cheating. Because if you do cheat, we're going to detonate this bomb collar.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's lots of ways you can kill somebody.
Okay, sure, that was what I was going for. There's lots of ways you can kill somebody.
Bomb collar, bomb bracelet, bomb belt.
All right.
I think the collar is not so much... sure, you could make it a collar. The collar's not really to prevent them from cheating. It's to prevent them from escaping from the game.
Right, which is breaking the rules of the game.
Okay, but that... Sure.
Point Wayne.
sure, yeah. Honorable, you are trapped, and we will keep you here. We're very honorable.
No, that's
you,
all. That's...
You getting out alive is breaking the rules. It's honor. It's our honor.
Well, you know, actually talking about that, where you have, you said like the Klingon games kind of thing. Maybe that's the idea, is that if your character is the first one to cheat, maybe that's what breaks the game. Nobody knows how to react, since it's always been an honorable event.
Hmm.
That could be fun.
Well, that just means you're a deviant in society if that's been going on for a long time and nobody's cheated.
If you're a player in a game, that's most likely the case.
Sounds like Captain Kirk. What was that, the Kobayashi?
Kobayashi.
Maru, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. And
it's like, oh, he cheated, therefore. He broke it.
So we're going to reward him with a captaincy, yeah.
Yeah. I think this is a very important decision point, is whether or not entering the game is voluntary or involuntary. In The Running Man, it's very much involuntary. That's something like The Hunger Games, and we debated this before, but yeah, sure, it is a little bit of both. It's mostly involuntary, but some districts have made it where it is very much voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't think about that, yeah, but there was that where, you know, some districts...
They do have the rule, you can always volunteer to replace somebody else, and then some people are just like, wow, I'm going to train to be really good at this, and
right.
I'll just volunteer regardless of who gets chosen, but right. It's really a lottery.
Right. Yeah. But there's ways you can increase your odds in the lottery.
And in The Long Walk, I'm not 100% sure if it's you choose to enter The Long Walk because you, in order to win this prize of anything you want, or if it's a lottery. Because the main character gets chosen to be in it, but his girlfriend tries to get him to back out. So maybe it is a little bit voluntary.
I could honestly see, for character creation, I could see benefits to either. Because making it sort of like an involuntary lottery, anybody and everybody can get picked. So you could end up with like wildly different characters. That's not to say you couldn't also have wildly different characters if it's voluntary.
Yeah, just they would all have different motivations.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the only thing that would be the same is, I want to do this.
One thing about the voluntary, though, it could be part of the game to find out why everybody else got involved.
Mm.
Because if you are trying to form alliances, that could be something. Is this person here for the game and like really hardcore, or is this person just... The society's beating them down so much and they're just trying to get whatever prize at the end. But
right.
That could be somebody that you could try to influence. It could be a combination of the both. Where some people volunteer to go in, which is, again, like Hunger Games, and some people are forced to go in.
Right.
But you can make it even more like, but yeah, I guess like Gladiators or like The Running Man, where a lot of people are just runners who are criminals are trying to kill off. But I think when you have voluntary, I mean, somebody's got to survive.
Right.
You can't.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Why'd you volunteer? I don't know. I'm kind of regretting it now.
Well,
yeah.
Okay, here's our one Star Wars reference for the episode.
I'm going to break the game.
No, not the same thing, but here's our one Star Wars reference for the episode. You know, episode one, that pod race. How many racers died during that stupid thing, and it was a voluntary race? Eventually, people say, you know, the hell with that course. We're not racing on it because everybody's dying.
Mm-hmm. But people are expected to win the game.
I could see where you have maybe a situation where you're have like a life sentence in prison, and you have a chance to win freedom, even though the chances are against you. You don't actually expect to survive, but it's better than just sitting in prison.
That's still voluntary. Yeah,
yeah.
Of course.
I think using your thing, if it was like you don't survive this game, it would be something along the lines of, yeah, I could be in prison for the rest of my life, or I could be executed, or I can volunteer for this game, and I get like 1 month in the lap of luxury, and then I play this game and die.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right,
That'd be okay. I'm not sure what game you would
necessarily I wouldn't know where you would go with a game, but yeah.
Well, I mean, you could spin it where, okay, if you win, it's not you who gets the reward, it's someone you name. And so then you could say, I am doing this so that, you know, my family gets whatever this reward is, or this person I love or care about gets whatever it is. And then yeah, you wouldn't need
someone shoots
a winner.
In the head.
All right, anticlimactic. But.
No, I like what you did there, but it was like, you've won the game, and you're just like, all right, your family's really going to appreciate it.
Well, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Do you want you want it from the back or the front? I don't
know. Surprise me. Yeah. No. I do like what you said about incorporating finding out why people entered the game. You know? I like that social spin it puts on the game because, as you said, you are going to be, or regular people are going to be more likely to team up with people who have more, you know, altruistic motives for joining up than people who joined up because they like to kill people and are planning on winning, you know? Yeah. Oh, why'd you volunteer? I like to kill people. All right, not going to be on a team with you.
You know, right. or plans, like...
Yeah.
And you can draw, not Dragoon, but you could, you know, maybe seek a player that likes to screw over the other players or might like to try it and say, do you want to be the game master's plant or the game runner's plant? And you're there just to make sure that the game goes along smoothly and that everybody gets a good show.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, that person can then be swayed. It's like, yeah, that's what you're there to do. What you want to do once the game starts is what you want to do.
That would be pretty cool. Yeah, we didn't think about putting, you know, plants or moles in the game. That'd be interesting.
You could even make that the game. I mean, people like Battlestar Galactica or Werewolf Resistance,
right?
And those kinds of games, where it's all about finding out who is the Cylon, who is the spy, Resistance,
yeah. Yep.
And I guess who is the Werewolf from Werewolf? I've never played it.
Yeah, that's how you make it that your social game. Then you make the game not about killing each other. Maybe the game is about figuring out who is who,
and then killing them. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, yeah. It's certainly not a game.
But you add that element to it, so you're playing the game, so you're doing that. But then you're also trying to guess who seems to be like who's the person that like destroyed the food and kind of build that. But you make that part of the thing, and people love that in the game. Is like, and one of you will be a traitor.
Right.
And I don't know, it's somehow part of the game's win conditions is one person can survive and the traitors can survive, or one of them has to kill the other, but something like that. And so everybody knows that you've got like 24, using Hunger Games, 24 tribunes. They know one of them is a traitor.
Right.
But they don't know which one, and it can come from any place.
No, I like that idea, and I think that might be something you would have to do where, okay, one, you know, if the regular person wins, well, then they win, or, you know, all the remaining spies can win. I think maybe that's something you would have to put in the game if you put kind of spies or plants in the game, because otherwise, and, you know, certain groups may do this, otherwise you're kind of just relying on people feeling bad when they're killing someone who is not a spy, which, you know, could be hard to do.
Oh, yeah, that's another thing. And you can also make it, like, where they don't know who is... How do they keep finding us? You know, and it's like, wow, no. I mean, you have that back and forth, so, yeah. A traitor might be a good thing to add.
It just kind of ratchets up the tension.
Yeah.
You know? Because it's definitely not... You know, a contest or a game, but would Battlestar Galactica, the newer series, be the same if there were not Cylons inside the fleet? You know, you're just kind of running from the Cylons. Oh, it's getting kind of boring. But now, you know, there's like a wolf among us doing stuff from the inside. Now things are getting tense.
Yeah.
But you mentioning, you know, kind of Hunger Games and how there's 24 tributes, I doubt a gaming group would have 24 people in it.
Oh, yeah, tributes, not tribunes. Sorry.
Well, if you just say tributes again, I can just splice it over. But
no, I'm fine with just putting that correction in.
All right.
Not fine with the discussion of being fine with putting in the correction.
Gotcha. But no, I doubt people would have, you know, I doubt people will have 24 players in their gaming group. So do you just have as many contestants as there are players, except for the one who has to sit out in BGM? Or do you have a bunch of NPC contestants in the game as well?
You know, NPC backups don't hurt, because if the game is about killing each other, there's a chance that you might need an extra character.
I would say there's not a chance. There's a really good one, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm not 100% understanding your question, but I would definitely have NPC contestants.
Right.
Not necessarily. And it just gives more characters for the people to interact with, and also to actually kill if they decide they don't want to make this a game of player versus player.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah,
it gives them natural opponents to kill and kind of stall until they figure out how to escape the game. Right. If that's what it is,
maybe that's a better way to phrase it. Then that could be another decision point. Are you just going to have your game be cutthroat right from the beginning, and the only characters in the game are player characters, or do you have a bunch of NPCs in the game as well, so that you can do exactly as you said, Lion, the players' characters can kind of stall or kill off NPCs until they figure out what they're going to do?
I think NPCs, because if it was just player characters, I think what would happen is, I mean, what would they do? They would either, like, okay, go, and then they all just sit there and fight,
right?
Like the Royal Rumble, which I think would get kind of boring.
Mm. You might as well play a war game then.
Yeah. Fortunately, yeah, it would be over in one session.
Right. Yeah. If you were doing a one shot, yeah.
Or they all run away. So, yeah, I think you definitely have to have NPCs. Or I mean, again, you could do like the Running Man where all the runners are player characters, but then you have the obvious antagonist of the stalkers chasing them. But if you have something like the Hunger Games or Battle Royale, then I think you need to have a mix.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, plus, and having a mix, you know, even if the players do, you know, split up from each other, which, you know, let's be honest, would be a pain for the GM to run, they would still have social interactions in the form of, you know, hopefully they would form a team, and then it would be, you know, PC leading a bunch of NPCs, hopefully, yeah, or tagging along, so there would be some interaction there, but...
Yeah.
I guess that's one of the dangers, is, as you said, Lyle, all the PCs just kind of run off in different directions, and the GM just kind of sighs and goes, all right, yep, now a scene with you, now a scene with you. Oh, you're all the way here on the other side of the map. All right, yeah.
I think, I mean, obviously we like the book Hunger Games, so they do a good job of forcing people to come together.
Right.
Because, yeah, a lot of times when you hear about these games, and you're like, okay, what I would do is I get in a tree, and I just sit there and wait, like if you're thinking of a paintball, and I'll just sit there and wait with my paintball gun and wait for somebody to walk, and then I'll shoot them.
Mm-hmm. Trees are bad ideas.
What's that?
Trees are bad ideas. When your opponent can shoot back, being in a place that you can't get out of easily is a bad idea.
Only if they see you first.
And then when they do, you're screwed.
Oh, yeah, when they're dead?
Oh, assuming that there's only one person at a time.
And assuming that you shoot them before they shoot you. Anyway, make your point.
Right. It's called an ambush.
From a tree.
Okay, whatever.
What are you, a drop bear? Fall out.
Yeah, and paintball. I'd actually just drop my gun on it. I wouldn't shoot. I'd just, like, drop it on him. I was like,
use my girth.
Did I get you? Oh, these things shoot? Oh.
All right, back to the point you were going to make.
Oh, that's what Lyle was talking about. I just thought my opponent shot.
Why didn't I listen?
All right, well, let's go on to the final decision point.
Which is, being in trees sucks.
Oh, I think it worked out for a certain someone named Katniss.
Oh, yes, because they didn't have guns.
Yeah, I doubt you're going to have a hornet's nest at the top of every tree you can drop on the people below you.
Yeah, and she had nothing, and somebody had a bow, and she's able to swim.
All right. Moving on.
All right. Obviously, you guys fell out of a tree at an early age and was terrified of them.
Actually, while playing paintball, yeah.
You don't call them cheese cookies. Death traps! And I suppose the best decision to make, and we actually talked about this before, but we didn't go into it too much, was what do you do after the game's finished? Now, in something like The Running Man, it kind of ends, you know, and that's the way that the game ends. It sort of breaks the society.
Mm-hmm. I just got the sense that Running Man would have had like an epilogue if it were a game where, you know, they just kind of run down what happened after the contest ended, but nobody really played anything, to put it into role-playing game terms.
Oh, you mean like you would give it like an American Graffiti epilogue?
Yeah, yeah. That's the sense I always got at the end of the Running Man movie. That's probably what would have happened.
Okay. And whereas with something like the Hunger Games or Battle Royale, it ends and you think there's more to the story.
Hmm.
Obviously, mm-hmm, the society is not great. People are unhappy with it. Is are these champions going to be a catalyst to something bigger? And just when we talked about that decision you make, is like, is the story the game, or is it more, it goes beyond the game? And the game can actually provide a very good way to set up the society and to build player rage against the society.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you can continue. And it's like you if you do something like the Hunger Games, in that they're introduced a little bit more. The actual characters don't know a lot about the society. So when they become part of the game, they actually have a period prior to the game where they become more inside to the corrupt society, or they see more of it.
Yeah, learn about it with the audience. Yeah.
Yeah. So the players can learn about it as their characters learn about it.
Right.
And then they can decide whether they want to do something about it. Or they could, and how they could do that, I mean, if you do have something where they become champions and therefore have some sort of elevated status, then they can be the enemy within that society. Ideally, I mean, if they're going to be heroes, they're going to be, like, try to do it. Or they could just become instantly resistant fighters or do something along those lines.
Mm. Well, you could kind of bring that back to what you were talking about before. Actually, both of you guys, how Wayne, you mentioned that you could make the entire group of contestants made up of prisoners of the society. But like you said, Lyle, you can make anybody a sympathetic character, so they could be all political prisoners. So they are sympathetic characters who've been downtrodden by a bad society that's worth taking down.
And you can even mix the honorable, dishonorable, where the society itself is actually really bad, and they force people to participate in this game. But if you win, I mean, they honor it. I mean, it doesn't matter what you did, and you were a prisoner. If you win the game, you win the game. Here's your prize. Like, we will honor that. You can still resent them. You're not going to go, I watched all my friends die, but hey, you know, I now have this penthouse, so yeah, I guess they're all right.
And we keep going back to it, but that's a bit like Gladiators, where if you fought well enough and got famous enough, you eventually won your freedom.
Right. But that doesn't mean that every gladiator then is going to be, this is okay, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that done really well in Spartacus, where watching how they, different slaves and different gladiators were kind of conflicted because, you know, what they knew before is was fine, or they accepted it, or they reached a certain status, and they're like, "Well, I'm fine now, so like I don't really care about the others."
Right. Mm-hmm. You mentioning the games being a good way to build player rage. I'm now wondering how many sort of one shot games you could play where you would intentionally kill off these player characters, before you could reach the breaking point, and players say that I'm kind of done with this,
The society or this game?
This game. I meant this game because, one, playing one or playing several short games would really drive home, things here really stink because I've killed, you've lost two or three of these characters you've played. But I guess the benefit to doing that is you now have three or four, however many winners in this game who can now become player characters if you then go on to play like a resistance style game. Or they could be NPCs that the player characters then interact with.
I see your point. Yeah, no, that would be interesting. It'd certainly be an interesting experiment, and it's really creative. I think you can build rage by doing stuff to the NPCs as well.
True. Or just kicking your players under the table. No? All right. I thought that was funny.
That's hilarious. All right, well, that ends our episode on Deadly Games, and just some questions you should ask yourself if you want to play with these types of games, because it can really influence, certainly, the style of game, of role-playing game that you would play.
Yeah, game is the buzzword, huh?
Yeah, when I was doing that, I was like,
We should have gone with, competition or something.
I tried
like
to say contest or competition, only because saying game all the time.
Oh, we should have established that RPG was going to be our game, or use that a lot. But yeah. Oh, well.
C'est la vie.
Good thing we
all right, well, thank you.
Good thing we hit on that in the final minute of
yeah, right. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there online or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can follow us on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. You can sign up in our Plus One Us on Google Plus. I can't figure that every time. I got to try it out. Or you can join up in our forums and talk to us there. They are at idleredhands.com/forums and hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much. And, of course, email us at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks very much, and see you next time.
May the odds be forever in your favor.
Nice one.
Mm.
Bye.
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 Oh, yeah, we never actually planned who else.
No, we didn't decide.
No, we didn't. Back to usual.
It's always like, hey, why aren't those guys speaking? So, yeah, I mean, that can be fun. Is it either you take a regular sport, and then you just make it more dangerous.
Death it up.
Death it up, yeah.
Cover everybody in spikes and chains.
Nobody noticed.
That's a fantastic way. That's the line for the episode.
Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Oh,
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.